Okay, if everybody make your way to a seat. I know y'all will be glad when this quarter's over. Y'all have had me for three quarters now, so we'll. But I enjoy it. We're in Romans 7. Most logical presentation that I've ever read. Book of Romans. Everything builds on what you've just learned. You know, I know I've worn out the thought, and I guess I want to say that whenever I wear y'all completely out on Romans, let me know, and I'll go find somebody else to wear out on it because I like it. I think... I was taught a lot of law growing up. I wasn't taught a lot about law. And I think there is a lifetime of learning about the concept of law, what it is and what it does and what it doesn't do, and the upside and the downside. And that's really the depth of the study, that the thread that runs through the first eight chapters of Romans is talking about law and our relationship to it. And I think a lot of us have, I don't want to accuse you of anything. Let me accuse myself. I still don't have as clear an understanding as I want to have, because there are some things about law that I still reach out to try to understand. I'm kind of at a point in my life now that I know that there are some parts of it that I don't understand and that I need to. Chapter 7 is going to verses 1 through 6. It's going to answer the question, are we bound to law as Christians? And the answer is what? No, we're not. When we get to verse 7, chapter 7, verse 7, then obviously we will have worked law over so hard that we will be thinking, well, then law is our problem. But we're going to find out that law is not our problem. And after we've said so many, in a way, so many negative things about it, then we get to thinking, hey, if we get rid of law, then our problems are solved. But we're going to find out, no, that's not true. This really is, this subject just keeps folding over on itself. He uses, and we went last time, we talked about, we're in the middle of answering some questions beginning in chapter 6, where he says, don't be liberal in the sense that you abuse God's grace and use it as an excuse to continue sinning, because where sin increased, grace increased all the more. Then he knows that he knows how we as humans think, and so he asks a series of questions in relation to that. And we know that we must not continue to practice sin as Christians, and he gave us some reasons why. And then he asks a second question in verse 15, shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? And the answer is the same as it was, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? No. He gives a different response after that to elucidate that matter, where he says, don't you know that you can only serve one master? And then he's going to show that we only have one master, because we were married to one when we were born. We were born married to law. You didn't have a choice about that. It's kind of like the family that you were born into. You didn't have a choice about it. But then somebody enabled you to have a choice, because the downside caught up with us. And the downside of being under law is there's a curse associated with it. Colossians tells us what that curse is. You remember what it was? Nobody remembers. We'll start back over at chapter 1 if somebody don't say something. Cursed is he that does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. You got to do it all. You got to do it all right all the time. You can't ever make one single mistake. So that caught up with us. And once it caught up with us, and once we transgressed law, then we appealed to law for help. And the law said, sorry, bud, I can't help you. All law can do is tell you how you should act and what's going to happen if you don't act that way. And so if you're going to stand before God and be judged and you're going to appeal to law or your goodness for your righteousness, then you need to know that there's a curse that you're going to have to deal with, and that curse is you can't make a single mistake your whole lifetime. Law is a good thing. In fact, he's going to say it's righteous and holy. But it's no good as a redeemer. It's no good as a savior. It doesn't have that ability to do that for you. As long as you never sin, law is good for you. But once you sin, all law can do is put the thumb down, condemn you. And so here we are married to law, and our spouse we've killed ourselves because of our spouse. But we can't do anything about it because we're bound to him until how long? Until death do us part. And so the only way we're ever going to be free from law, from the dominion, the control, the domination of law, is somebody's got to die. And we think through that process and we say, well, the only one that can die and do me any good is law. And so we've got to put law to death. We've got to do away with law. But if we were able to do that, what kind of life would you have if you didn't have law? What kind of society would we have if we didn't have law? If we killed law, we'd be in a world of hurt, wouldn't we? You want to live where there's no law? Boy, I don't want to live where there's no law. The fact the New Testament tells me that the law is for godless people. They're the ones who need law, because law sets the boundaries and the penalties associated with it, and there are some people that can't operate without that. They have to have that in order to make them behave. There are other people who you don't have to threaten them to get them to do right. I'm talking just generically now. But there are some people in our society, if it were not for law and law enforcement officers and the penalty associated with law, then you don't want people like that as neighbors, do you? Because they'll kill you. They'll lie to you. And not have, you know, they've done it so much that it doesn't even bother their conscience anymore. And they live for that kind of stuff, anarchy. And so here we are married to law, and if we kill law off, you know, we may think we've solved that problem, but we got a bigger problem, don't we? Or we have a really big problem that we can't solve. And so we think, okay, I'm in this relationship, and it's a dead end. There's nothing that anybody can do to help me out of it. But God devised a way that you can break that dominion that law has on you. Without killing law, you can die. And you say, well, what good is that? I'm dead. Well, what if you could die and come back to life? Well, that's pretty bizarre, isn't it? But that's exactly what took place, Romans chapter 6. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. Why? You died. You died. When did you die? Well, he went into great length in Romans chapter 6, the first 7 verses, to tell you when you were baptized with Christ, you were baptized into his death. And you were buried with him. And you were raised with him. You died. when you, as a faith response, were immersed, then the old you died, and a new you. And he says, verse 11, in this same way, I'm back in chapter 6, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Incredible. How could anybody ever come up with a plan like that? Yes, sir.
When we read chapter 7 of Romans, it really brings to my mind more of an understanding of the multitude of each of us. Because God created us one person, but within that one person, he created several natures.
That's correct. In fact, we've talked about... We've talked about two, but we're probably going to come up with the third one here in a minute.
So that's really the interesting thing to me about Romans 7 is until we really educate ourselves as to these three parts of ourself,
yeah,
you can't really fully appreciate baptism.
That's correct.
You can't really appreciate the life, the abundant life that you can have on this earth while we're still in these three natures.
And to know and to... begin to realize in our lives the blessings of a new life, of a new you, a new start, completely new. Not having to answer for the old you. Then you can start living for the first time in your life. We've been talking about why you're dead, how he made you alive, and how he keeps you alive. And he's done those things for us. We were dead in our trespasses and sins. And there were lots of consequences to that. Dead end, death was the end. And he made us alive in Christ Jesus. And he enabled us to crucify that old self and put it in the grave. It's past history, folks. And so don't drag that carcass around with you. That's a pretty nasty thought, isn't it? That you got this old carcass that's decayed and rotten and you're dragging it around with you all the time. There are lots of Christians who are doing that very thing. You won't let it go. Let it go. Let it go. You've got a new life. And it's an incredible thing that he's done for us. And then the first six verses, he says, are you married to law? The answer is no. You've been released from law. In verse 4, beginning, he's going to elaborate to us what law did. He says, so my brothers, you also died to the law through the body of Christ so that you might belong to another. That's the purpose of it, not just dying for the sake of dying, but for the sake of being married to another. And the result of that is that we might bear fruit to God. Heretofore, I don't care how good you thought you were, the fruit that you bore in your life before you became a Christian was not unto God. It wasn't his fruit. It may have been your own, out of your own power that you operated. But now it's his. It's, if you will, since you're married to him, it's his children. Okay? Does that make sense to you? In fact, Paul will write in other epistles that, and this is a pretty mature audience, and it's in the Bible, so we can handle it, right? He said, he has put his seed in us. And the word for seed is sperma. And now, because of that, this is pretty literal, isn't it? Now, because of that, the fruit that you bear is God's. And so you don't want to go back and bear fruit of Satan, do you? We don't want to go back to the world. Because now his seed is in us. And we're able to produce fruit for him from this point on in our lives. And so he says, for when we were controlled by our sinful nature, that would be before we became a Christian and that nature was crucified, The sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our bodies so that we bore fruit for death. But now, by dying to what once bound us, that would be what? Law. Dying to what once bound us, we have been released from the law. Not just the consequence of it, but from the dominion of it. We were married to law, and it had dominion over us. It controlled us. It was our controlling force in our life. But now, he says, watch what he says. Now that we've been released from that dominion of law, we serve in the new way of the Spirit, or in newness of spirit, and not in the oldness of what is written, literally. Now, he has planted his seed in us. Now we have what Jesus talked to that woman at the well in Samaria about. You remember? If you knew who it was talking to you, you would ask water from me. And that water would be living water that would well up in you unto life. Folks, the Lord's done some incredible things for us. And we go around with our head down looking at our feet as if we can just barely get along. He has lifted us to a place that is incredibly higher than how this world operates. We think differently. We act differently. We are different. Are you not a different person than you were years before? Before you became a Christian, are you not a different person now? You have a different nature in you than you've ever had before. Now, boy, there are so many passages right here that come to my mind. In fact, I've got about 7 or 8 passages that are written right here. And I'd like to read some of them. I won't take the time to really elaborate on them. My sound booth guy's gone. If we had a microphone, I'd pass the microphone around. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. 2 Corinthians. I don't do this very much in this class because I like to stay in the context, but this is a really good point to do that. And it's in view of this concept that we serve in the new way of the Spirit, not in the old way of what is written. Pick up in verse 4 of chapter 3, 2 Corinthians. Such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we're competent of ourselves to judge anything we do, but our competence comes from God. He has enabled us to be ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Now, that last phrase is deeper than I know how to fathom. But pretty regularly I try to go and peck on it a little bit to try to understand it. The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Tell me some of what he means by when he says the letter kills. The letter of the law. How does it kill? Tell me, give me an illustration. Help me understand what he means when he says the letter kills. Okay. Okay, it is the biggest portion of it is, there's some positive things in the law. Thou shalt do this and thou shalt do that. Yes, ma'am? And if you would, speak as loudly as you can, so back here. Right. Now, I think that's a pretty good analysis of the basis of what he's saying, literally. I mean, we got a picture here. Something dies, doesn't it? Something's got to die. And what was it under the old covenant that died? Animals died. How many would you suppose? And I wouldn't even know how to begin to guess how many million animals. And there was something about every one of those animals. They were innocent. They didn't do it. They didn't deserve to die, did they? And so that's I think, a visual illustration of a spiritual truth. The visual is when that guy came up and brought his lamb before the door of the tabernacle and he laid, you know, presented it to the priest. He finally got to the front of the line. He presented it to the priest, and the priest walked around it and looked at it up and down and in and out and as much as he could and saw there was no blemish, and he stood back and nodded his head, and the guy placed his hand on the head of that lamb, and then he took that lamb's head and lifted it up, and he unsheathed his knife, and he slit that lamb's throat, and that lamb went down on the ground, and without a sound, its life's blood flowed out. And as that man sat there and watched that lamb dying, he knew something. He knew a lot of things. One of the things that he knew was that lamb shouldn't have had to die. That lamb didn't do anything. I'm the one that did it. And this lamb is dying because of my sins. And so, the letter of the law, I mean, if you're gonna hold people's feet to the fire, and you're going to say, okay, you got to do this and 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 this, and you got this list, the law lists all these things, and if you're going to say that's the way that you're going to be saved, is you're going to keep that law, then you need to know something. That law is going to kill you. It's not going to give you life. It's going to kill you. Yes, ma'am?
I think another way the law kills you is it makes us all live in constant fear of one another. We become police officers checking each other to make sure we're following the law, and then some of us become lawyers defending one another, and then we'll become a judge deciding, you know, between the two cases, and suddenly our focus is not on Jesus or the joy or in trying to bring others to Him. We're all caught up in who's done what wrong, and even if you're not breaking the law, you're still afraid.
That's right. Good. That's a really, really good. Yes.
This is a little bit long, but the best illustration I've seen of it was Paul Looney, that's a Christian psychiatrist in the Woodlands. Some of you may know him. He does a session called Out of Egypt, which deals with defense mechanisms that we develop as children and can't get rid of as adults. But the way he illustrates it is he sets 10 simple rules that everybody agrees to keep, like I'll be on time to each session, I won't talk without being recognized, I'll finish all the exercises. And then when somebody violates that, he makes them stand up and explain why and embarrasses them in front of everybody, which illustrates their defense mechanisms. But after going through 3 days of that, he has never had a session where people kept all 10 rules. And the final exercise, he says, would you like to get rid of these rules now and be under a law of grace? And everybody votes to be under a law of grace and get rid of those 10 rules.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, when we see how impossible it was for the Jews to be justified by the law of laws, by strict rules, we see how important the law of grace is for us.
That's a good illustration. Thank you for that. And I'm reminded, when we see somebody else get in trouble because they pop their mouth off, you know, then we think, okay, I'll keep my mouth shut, and I'll be cool. But that doesn't cover all of them, does it? It might, you know, if you kept your mouth shut and never said another word for the rest of your life, what you find out in the Sermon on the Mount is, unfortunately, what you think counts. It's not just what you say. It's what's in your heart. So how are you going to control that? Well, we're going to find out a little bit later over here that he's going to teach us that external rules can't control your heart. That's the big problem with law. It can't control what's in your heart. You can keep rules and be the biggest hypocrite in the world. Can't you? That's where the Pharisees were, weren't they? Isn't it? Jesus came down hard on them because they had all these rules. Well, actually, they had the ones that they chose to enforce. Really, they picked the ones that, you know, they pick and chose the ones that they wanted, and they really hammer those, and then others. That's Jesus said that to him, didn't he? He said the weightier matters of the law. You do all this tithing and Sabbath keeping and all this kind of thing, and he said, and in the weightier matters of the law, you leave undone. Didn't he say that? And so it didn't touch her heart. And that's the problem with law. It doesn't touch our heart. I mean, don't you know some people that are big-time religious people, but they're as mean as a junkyard dog? I mean, you know, they'll smile sometime, and if they're not real careful, they'll have fangs with blood dripping off of them. Man, I've known some Christian, quote, people that way. They're mean. They're tough. They'll bite your throat out, you know, and then sit back and watch you die. And so, did you have something, Sam? I'm sorry. I thought I saw you hang up. And so he says, now we're released from the law so that we serve in a new way of the Spirit, not in the old way of the written code. And I'm going to suggest to us that we're going to spend the rest of our life finding out what he means right there. And I'm going to also suggest that it's real important that you spend some time studying and praying about what he means right there. That we serve in the way, the new way of the Spirit, and not in the old way of the written code. And here's some other passages that I wrote down, if you'd like to read them in conjunction with that. I'm not going to take the time to go there. Galatians chapter 5, verse 14. Romans chapter 13, verse 10. Matthew chapter 22. Verse 34 through 40. You can write those down and go study those for yourself in conjunction with what he's saying there. But I think these have bearing on what he's saying, that now you're no longer married. If you're a Christian, then you died. You've been brought back to life to be married to another so that now you can bring forth fruit unto life. And you don't serve from this point on. You don't serve in the way of the old written code. But now you serve in newness of spirit. You got a new spirit, a new attitude, a new life. And now he's going to ask a third question, and we've been looking at those questions since chapter 6, verse 1. What shall we say? Shall we go on sinning that sin may increase? The second one is in verse 15. What shall we say? Because shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? And then his third question is, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? And we get right here, and by the time we've talked about talked about law so much, we get to the point where we say, well, law is our problem. So we need to get rid of law. Is the law sin? And up to this point, every time he's asked a question, what has been his response? No. And here, guess what he says? Is the law sin? No. The law is not our problem. Now he's going to tell us what the purpose of law is. I would not have known what sin was except through the law. So what does the law do? What's one of the things, one of the purposes that the law serves? Tells me what sin is. It identifies sin, right? And so he says, and then he gets more specific, for I would not have known what it was to covet if the law had said, do not covet. Now, I don't know for sure why he picked that one. Maybe because it's one that we tend to think is not a big deal. And maybe because, opinion right here, maybe because this is the sin that underlies all other sins. Now you have to think about that a while and see if you think that's true. I happen to think it's true. I think that's the sin that is the foundation for all other sins. And I'm not smart enough to really say all, but I'll say all until you come to me and show me one that's not. Okay? Yes, sir. That's right, and those are examples of lusting, isn't it? Coveting after. That's the basis of it. And you know, we would just look that one right over, wouldn't we? We'd really never know the seriousness of lusting or coveting. if the Bible hadn't told us that, would we? I mean, after all, it's just human nature, right? Isn't that our explanation when we do something wrong and we say, well, that's just human nature? Well, mark it down. From now on, for the rest of your life, every time you say or every time you hear someone say, well, that's just human nature, mark it down, you're talking about sin. You check it out and see if that's not true. From now on, every time you hear somebody say, well, that's just human nature to do that. It's just natural to do that. Whatever it is you're talking about is sin. Devil made me do it. That's right. That's right. Yeah, Flip's getting lots of. Yes.
I think it's important we be real specific here. That nature is the sinful nature that we read so much about.
That's right.
And I personally believe that's the only nature that we have. And he's going to talk about that today. You know, how it's always there. And we need to remember that because we've been called to live this life, this new life in the Spirit. And we're going to struggle with achieving that maybe the rest of our life.
When you say that's the only nature we have, it's the only natural nature. The Lord gives us another, right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. By the way, you know, I don't want to get philosophical here, but what John just said is the difference between psychiatry and psychology. Is one believes that you have this one, that man's nature is essentially bad, and one begins with the premise that man's nature is essentially good. Now, check it out. But anyway, we do have, those of us that are Christians, we have been given another nature. Now, whether or not we grow that nature, we have a choice about that, don't we? I mean, we've been given a new life. We got a new marriage going on here. We're married to Christ now. We have a new nature, and that new nature is totally different, and we need to understand something about that nature so we can cultivate that nature. And that new nature is going to reap some benefits that we cannot have any other way, such as peace. Peace. And the comments that were made over here a few moments ago about how under law we're just wired. I mean, we're tensed up and we're everybody's enemy and we're everybody's judge and everybody is our judge and we live that way in fear. Well, we don't have to live that way. We're family. We're forgiven. You're a sinner, and so am I. And I'm no better than you, and you're no better than me. The ground at the foot of the cross is level. And I don't have to make you be bad in order to make me look good. I can come to your side, and I can encourage you, even if you do better. You know, it's something I've been thinking about. It's one of those back burner sermons here that probably come out for too long. I wonder how many of us in our life have room in our life to encourage somebody who does better than we do. I'm going to tell you what, not many people. I mean, when somebody looks like they're about to pass us up, we got to block them. You know, and we got lots of ways to block them. I mean, we'll do it real subtly. We'll do it real Christianly. You know, we'll go behind their back, you know, and put them down and talk about them. But how many of us truly can let somebody pass us up and encourage them, and they do better than we do? Man, the only way you can really do that with all your heart is if you really are confident in yourself about your own salvation. And when you get there, you don't have to put anybody else down. You don't have to criticize anybody else. You know, it's hard to be around somebody that puts you down all the time, isn't it? You don't want to be around that kind of person after a while. If you got a choice, you're going to try to get away from them after a while, aren't you? And so he says, the law said don't covet. But now he begins a two-word phrase, and he'll have it in verse 8. It says, and remember his question was, is a law sin? And he says, no. The law is not sin. The law lets us know what sin is. So what is our problem? Sin. That's our problem. In verse 8, but sin. Look at verse 11. For sin. Look at verse 13. In order that sin might be recognized as sin. Your problem is not law. Your problem is sin. What is sin? Breaking law. So the problem is not law. The problem is you can't keep it. You won't keep it. Sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment. Now, I love that phrase. It's a little complex. But when you get it, when you get your mind around it some, you really learn to appreciate it. Sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. Boy, we got to step down two or three steps here. We got to scrape away some stuff to understand this. Sin, seizing the occasion or the opportunity afforded by the commandment. What in the world does that mean? Well, this is my illustration about the park bench. Here you are, beautiful sunshiny day, and you're walking along and enjoying the birds singing and the beautiful grass and the flowers come out. And you walk through a park and you look over there and there is a park bench that has freshly been painted. It's bright green. And on it, there is a sign that says, do not touch, wet paint. Now, I want you to tell me what you do. Why are you laughing? For some reason, it's inside of here, isn't it? Would you have ever done that? We all know what I'm talking about, don't we? You're going to look around and see if anybody's watching. And you're going to kind of sideways step over there. And you're going to look and make sure nobody's watching. And you're going to touch it and see if it's really wet. Now, would you tell me, would you have ever gone over and touched that bench with your fingertip if that sign didn't say, do not touch? Would it have ever crossed your mind to do that? You would not in your wildest, on your wildest, craziest day, you would not have gone over and stuck your finger on that bench and looked at the end of your fingertip. Why did you do that? Because the commandment said, don't do it. The occasion, it brought an occasion for you to do what? It created in you a desire that you didn't have before. Now, folks, you need to do some thinking about this. Law does this to you. Law's good. He's going to say, law's good and righteous and holy. But whenever you mix law and my nature, then there is an occasion that is created by law that wasn't there before. It created in me all manner of evil desires, he will say. Why does law do that to us? Why can't we just say, that says don't do that, so I won't ever do that? Why can't we say that?
Because we're not strong enough to say
it. We're not strong enough, and we have a nature that is rebellious, don't we, Butch? That's right. That's right. And law plays into that, doesn't it? It plays into this nature that we have. And it does something weird with us. Yes, ma'am.
But if we have enough faith in the park manager, we'll know that the bench is wet and we won't go over there.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Unless he left that sign on there too long. No, you're exactly right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. You're exactly right. Do what?
Or if the sign had not said, do not, if it just had even said wet paint,
yeah.
More people would have trusted that it was wet as
yeah.
opposed to telling you not to do it.
Yeah. And you know, let's finish reading this, and I want you to do some thinking about it so we can talk about this, because I really think we're at a real important point where we need to do some thinking right here. He says, sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment. By the way, he is personifying sin here. What does that mean, to personify something? It means to take an inanimate object and make it appear as if it is a real live person. And so he is, and by the way, this is not just a figure of speech here. Sin is active. When it got into this universe, sin doesn't just lie dormant there and you can walk by and take it or not. Sin is in your face. Sin is after you. Sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment. You see, Satan is, God created the world and he created a perfectly beautiful place where every desire of man's heart was fulfilled. And here he living in the paradise, and it's like there's this bubble here that God's created this beautiful, perfect place, and Satan's on the outside, and he's desperate to get in here. And he can't find a way to get in. And he's running back and forth, and he's looking at every angle, trying to figure out how he can mess this up. And he just can't stand it. And then he sees that sign on the tree that says, don't touch it. And he said, that's my way in. That's how I get to these people. And then he goes to the woman, and he said, did God say, and how did he use that commandment? To create in her. Do you think she was okay with that tree and leaving that tree alone up to that point? She was. She could enjoy all the beauties of what God had created in that garden, couldn't she? But whenever that got planted in her mind, you know what? God doesn't want you to be as smart as he is. That's why he's told you that. God didn't tell you all the truth here. And all of a sudden, she couldn't sleep at night. That's all she could think about. And then she started walking by that tree all the time, constantly, back and forth. And she saw it, and it looked really, really good. And she was turning this over in her mind. What has happened? Sin taking occasion afforded by the commandment. There was a commandment, and Satan said, that's my chance. That's the way I get in. And he got in, didn't he? And he said, the King James says, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. All manner of evil desire started coming out all of a sudden. Aren't we something? God gives us all of this. He blesses us. He creates us in a perfect relationship with himself, and then it comes along, and we can't stand it. We've got to mess it up. And we royally mess it up. And we can't undo it. We can't get back. But God so loved the world, didn't he? That he gave his only begotten son, because he wanted you back. You made a stupid, stupid, stupid mistake. You sinned. You rebelled. But he still wanted you back. Now that's pretty incredible, isn't it? Okay. Thanks. We'll pick up there next week, Lord willing.